Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. And as we kind of go into more content, we are going to cover the Assumption Act. But we got good news. We got Tammy back. We've got Sean back. And we've got me to kind of keep peace. Not that there's any hostility at all to worry about. But anywho, we have wrapped up the Constitution. Now, let me remind you to Learn, Pray, Act. Let me emphasize the actual national, there is a national call. I mean, we've posted one. If you want to host your own, we'll post that as well. But please, you know, try to, you know, join in, especially if you're a believer in, you know, group prayer and so forth. By all means, you're more than welcome to participate. That being said, it's all about compliance of the Constitution, which is why we go through this content, so that you understand what they did, why they did it, and what we're covering now is some things that they did that they shouldn't have done, that they didn't have the authority. So what really matters isn't really the deals and everything else or some of the debates of what, you know, these acts, like the Assumption Act. The Assumption Act was unconstitutional. But as we just kind of read, that the Union was literally at a point, because they just formed, they just ratified this thing, and now the states that had to actually had to pay their debt, the time of reckoning was coming to say, hey, you got to pay this debt. So Hamilton came up and he concocted a scheme of basically creating a level of debt that everybody would actually have to pay, that everybody would kind of be involved, but there would be a greater advantage to those who actually paid their debt and a less advantage to those who didn't. And so they break it all down. We're going to kind of go through it. And to me, it's not as important as the fact, did they have the authority to do what they were doing regarding the Assumption Act? Now, the real problem wasn't the unconstitutionality of the Assumption Act. There was a little bit of latitude because the federal government could create the debt. But the mechanism and what and how they did this was really a justification of creating a bank. When we say bank, we're not just talking about a bank that's going to print money or coin money and, you know, manage money. This national bank that Hamilton was creating was going to produce products. In other words, it was going to generate loans, it was going to create bonds and pay interest and so forth. It was a legitimate commercial bank. Now, there's the fact is everybody realizes that the first charter of the National Bank was bad, and everybody just assumes that the second charter of the National Bank was bad equally. You have to compare the two charters of the first charter and the charter that Madison created to realize that Madison did not create a bank that was going to be capable of creating products. It was literally a bank to help be the platform or the mechanism of taking on foreign debt, because it's something that they never really fixed during peacetime. And when Madison was actually confronted, because by the point in time that when he was in office and Britain had invaded, the War of 1812. Now's not the time to try to figure out how to do this. Now's the time to say, how can we get money from foreign investors or from foreign nations to actually pay us, you know, to pay us so that we can afford to fight back? So he created a charter that took on debt, and it there was a plan to pay that debt off. He wasn't out there doing schemes like what Hamilton was doing. So that's what we're going to get into. Again, it's all about compliance of the Constitution, and really, we just finished covering the Constitution. We literally, on Tuesday, on Veterans Day, we wrapped up the covering of the Constitution, and covered the last amendments. And now that I've got the gang together, because I could have done this with Sean, but, you know, I wanted to actually do this so that we kind of jointly talk about what we read, what we learned. Is there anything we did? And actually, I'm soliciting, you're more than welcome to provide us any feedback on what we could have done to have, you know, provided better information or covered it better, what have you. Now, barring plastic surgery and those types of comments, you know, there's only so many things we can do, right? So, anywho, let me just kind of open the floor up and actually, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know, as you're listening, take note. Go back. If you've listened to most all of the reading of the Constitution, you paid attention to what we how we covered it, then take note and just let us know if you garnered something different or what have you. But anyway, so Tammy, this is the second time, so I'm going to pick on you first. Did you get anything more, even though it may have been, you know, just partial? What more did you get or did you learn out of reading the Constitution this time around?
I think that I wish you would have asked me to think about this a little bit beforehand.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, you know, every time we read something, if you know, wow, I don't remember reading this before. Usually those types of things stick out. Were there anything that, you know, it was like you were hearing it for the first time? And I know that you were gone for a good percentage of it, so there wasn't a lot that you heard in duplication. Does that make sense?
I think for me, just the honing in on the fact that the states are the parties to the contract, and the states are the ones that have the authority to rectify this overstepping of the government. And that's something that I've come to understand in a much greater depth, I guess you could say.
Okay, great. So, I asked, and actually I think you were the only one there, is there a, because I know I've already polluted the water, actually it's probably best, I could ask Sean. Sean, because there's no right or wrong, right? It's just whatever we think. As a matter of fact, let me give a little history about right and wrong. Because, you know, sometimes we really think that the way we see things is the only way we see things. And on a very personal side, my father, who I've gotten the heavy influence of wanting to know these things and the truth and all of that, my father, you know, being a man that, you know, has made his own conclusions on right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, came up with a conclusion that one person was the most important person involved in the founding of this country. And the person that he came up with is who had the greatest influence. What man had the, and I think the question was, and it went to my wife, who was the man that, you know, had the greatest influence on America? And what she didn't even come up with a framer or a founder. She came up with somebody completely different. And my father, the way that question was, it was so subjective. Very, very subjective. So there was no wrong answer, if that makes sense. But my father treated her answer as it was wrong. And boy, did he get a backlash. Because he kind of set her up, and then he dragged me into it, having heard what happened, and I go, you know, how can you, know, Dad, how can you, you know, get me to kind of support what you just did? And he looked at me, well, what did I do? And I said, you asked her a subjective question. And she answered that with based on how she saw things, and you didn't accept it. And you can't do that. You can't tell somebody, you know, what do you think? And then tell them they're wrong with how they think. Especially when it's not something that, you know, it's not like, what is 2 + 2? You're asking who you thought was, and I said, so, you know, this created a bone of contention. And so there's, like I said, there's really no right or wrong here. And I honestly believe that there's people out there that really cling to what they think is the most important part of the Constitution. Ah, so a few shows back, probably, Tammy, you remember, I said, you know, I used to think that Article 7 was the most important part of the Constitution, because it's very common, and why am I even spending this much time on this? What do you think these organizations that are founded on one part of the Constitution are doing? Do you think the Second Amendment organizations are basically lauding and speaking all about the freedom of religion? No. They have cherry-picked the one thing that they believe and they argue is the most important thing. And that's their right when it comes down to, you know, what they think is important. So, Sean, now, I mean, you know, I can only think that the tension is only mounting because the question hasn't landed yet. So I apologize for taking so long. I'm just trying to set the stage here. What part of the Constitution do you think that you appreciate or think is the most important, or however you want to frame it? What did you take away? What is the one part? Wow, that is such an important part. This is what we need to focus on, or what have you. Is there anything?
I think the initial three words connected to, is it Article 4, Section 4, or is it 6, Section 4, about the Republican form of government? I think that's the most important part, because that sets in no uncertain terms that the people are the actual ones who are establishing the government.
Right. Okay.
And the most important person for the framing is Jesus.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I think there was a little bit more qualification for my father on that one, but be that all as it may.
Oh, is that what he said?
No. Actually, my father, when it came down to living persons, what have you, I don't think that he would have denied Christ.
Oh, okay.
But it was really more of, you know, mortal men. His opinion was,
okay,
it was
there you go, mortal men.
Mortal
all
men.
The other qualifiers.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure he had it. I just didn't reaccount everything, but I'm just, it wasn't good. And I, you know, basically, you know what happens when you step into the middle of a knife fight? You usually get a knife in your chest, but,
right.
You know, with this, I'm trying not to set that stage. I think that it's important that people start thinking, you know, what is important and why is that important and why would I say that? Because now it kind of, it forces you to take a side. It forces you to pick something, right? And so with Tammy.
Say Article 14, Section 3.
Oh, so the 14th Amendment, Section 3. So what is that and why is that so important?
So that, you know, that allows us to remove anybody who has violated our Constitution. So
yeah, violated
no
the
person
rules,
shall
correct.
Be any public servant, civil or military, senator or representative in Congress.
There you go. Okay. So it's the one part of the Constitution that holds every oath holder accountable to their oath. You know what, Tammy? Mm-hmm. I love that. I'm surprised that you would select that. But, you selected what I believe is probably the most important part. Because it's all about accountability. I mean, when we look at our life, when we look at what we do, you know, if you're an employee, the employer has the burden of making sure that their employees are being held accountable. If they don't, those employees can destroy their business. If And that's what our public servants are. They are our employees. They're being charged with the ability to do these very specific things. And so understanding certain things, because my argument before used to be, as I said, Article 7. What is Article 7? Article 7 is just the simple process of how this Constitution actually, you know, takes validity. How does it become a valid governing document? It's Article 7. And Article 7 identifies what the Constitution is, and it identifies who the parties to it are, which all of a sudden removes the Supreme Court. It removes the president, and it removes Congress from being those bodies that, you know, they are the ones in charge. They're not the parties to the compact. They're the creatures created from the compact. So Article 7 actually identifies that the Constitution is a compact because it has multiple parties, and it requires at least 9 parties to ratify before the Constitution becomes valid. So in reading that, one would think that, you know, this is just a perfunctory administrative part of the Constitution. It's the least important. But what you garner from it is you really garner, who is it that's supposed to be holding the federal government accountable? It is the parties to that compact. In other words, they're the ones that should be exercising Section 3 of the 14th Amendment on these tail sides of every public servant that is out, you know, in these positions. The only person, the only public servants that are not in, covered or in, encompassed under the accountability of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the President of the United States and the Vice President. That's it. Everybody else can be removed based on Section 3. It excludes them because they actually have an impeachment process that's been used and works. And they want to make sure that it's done in more of a due process form so that the whole world can understand what, you know, happened. Why is the president being removed? Because when you look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, there's no due process, and the whole world would go, whoa, what happened to all those guys? Well, we got rid of them. Why? Because they violated the oath. How? We don't care. You know, we don't need to necessarily worry about that, blah, 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 blah. And so it just shocks people that there is a mechanism that doesn't really require due process. All it requires is hard evidence that you've proven that they violated their oath, they're gone. It doesn't matter how they want to justify it. If it's been proven that they did it, and sometimes it is literally just how they voted on a bill. If they voted on an unconstitutional bill, that's done. That's evidence enough. The vote for that bill is where you violated this part of the Constitution because it says you're not supposed to make a law to do that. Anyway, in Washington,
do you know of any state constitutions that have a clause like this in their constitution?
So there are some states that actually have removals of people violating their oath. Yes, I think Missouri is one of them. I think some of them, you know, they have them, but 9 times out of 10, they really don't invoke it, and usually they try to include a due process. In other words, they still want to have the honor amongst thieves that, you know, it requires a majority vote to or two-thirds vote or what have you. I think the Constitution requires a two-thirds vote for the removal of any congressman. But that's not accounting for that's not using the Section 3 process. Section 3 process does not require a two-thirds vote. It doesn't even really require a vote. If, you know, if the evidence is that clear, if the evidence is that overwhelming, it just should be a no-brainer. You got to go, man. I'm sorry. You know, man, you kicked the guy's dog. We saw it. There's the video. Right?
If we're able to get a Republic Review bill passed and we do an audit, we're able to do an audit, and then we can start working on the state audit, and we start noticing, hey, that senator or representative voted against the Constitution. I feel like that's something that would we have to make another bill so that we could mm-hmm. remove them.
Right. Yeah, so the importance of accountability is huge. It is integral to the success of any organization, making sure that we can hold people accountable. And I think that was the one reason why the 14th Amendment really, you know, because the Constitution was lacking this. There was just nowhere in the Constitution where we just had any form of process for redress for bad behavior by somebody in office. I mean, let's look today. How many people in Congress today? I mean, I get here, I constantly be asked, I'm asked the stupidest questions regarding AOC, Ilhan, you know, the mobs and what have you. And I'm going, you know, why do we need to actually, you know, go through an impeachment? Why do we need to do this repeal? They've literally violated their oath. Just enforce the law. But, you know, that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
Sean, anything else you want to throw in or you want to add or what have you? By all means, please, feel free.
I thought it was not surprising that we all three chose what we chose.
Uh-huh.
And nobody said, oh, I like Article 2 because of the president or the Congress. Uh-huh. No, it was the people.
Yes. Well, so
the states and throw them bums out.
Yeah, yeah. So reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. You know, and all of these things are important. But I think when we really start looking at what is the solution, because really it comes down to, let me pick on the John Birchers, because they harp on the oath. As a matter of fact, if you go to their website and you listen to their mantra, they talk about Article 6 being the most important part. It's like they're completely ignoring Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And I think that they do that because they don't want to get caught up in the whirlwind of anything bad because these patriot groups over here hate the 14th Amendment. You know what? I don't even hate the 17th Amendment. John Birchers do, because they look at the 17th Amendment as the boogeyman that destroyed the Senate. No, it didn't. This is why we prove otherwise. It's the same thing with the 16th Amendment. Even though these amendments that have been, you know, blamed as the boogeyman of derailing our government, they didn't do that. That wasn't in the language of these amendments. And so it baffles my mind to see and watch and hear, you know, good people making arguments that actually, I'm going, what? Why would you care about the oath of office if you're not holding the people accountable to that oath? Oh, well, we want to hold them accountable. Then you need to be actually bringing up Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because that's the law. Anyhow, so one of the things, and the reason why this is actually kind of important, and we need to actually have a very civil and maintain civility, because, you know, I know when I mention somebody like the John Birch Society, 10th Amendment Center, it doesn't matter. There's all these different organizations out there that I could easily be listing that, you know, I do that just with a broad, you know, backhand when I mention Second Amendment folks, because there's another group. Can I say this? And I'm asking both of you, so whoever wants to start first, by all means. Can I say that if you're not a part of the solution, you've got to be a part of the problem? In other words, if we're not holding people accountable to their oath and demanding their removal and demanding full compliance of the Constitution, because that's the solution, can I actually say that and say, if you're not a part of the solution, then you're a part of the problem? And this is perfect timing because you both have a shot at, you know, a minute or two in waiting so that you can think about, you know, yeah, you can say that. Or no, GR, I think you're going, you know, too far. I honestly believe that you can't have your feet in both sides. You have to be full on in being a part of the solution, or you are a part of the problem in whatever little way. I'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
The old break, buying some time. I mean, anyway, I don't think it's that big of a deal, but, you know, I just think it's apropos. I mean, it's just the right thing to say. If you're only supporting, you know, partially the problem, but you're supporting... but you're supporting the solution as well, then you're still part of the problem. Does that make sense? I mean, do you think, Sean? Go ahead, Tammy.
It's just a distraction from the real solution. So, yeah, it's part of the problem.
Right. Okay. Sean, what do you think?
I say it's a terms of the contract issue.
Okay.
It's like we talk about all the time. The terms are the terms. They're not, oh, well, you know, we've gotten to this point, so now we need to do this other thing that this made up, you know, because of our interpretation of what we think this is. No, the terms of the contract are the terms of the contract, period.
Right. Okay. All right. So do you believe?
And I think that what they do is it belittles our sovereignty as free individuals when you start parsing things. The bottom line is that, like you talk about all the time, we're the parents, the government is our creation, not the other way around.
Right. Okay. So, to make me feel better, because the question was, can I actually say that if you're not fully on board with being a part of the solution, you are a part of the problem? Now, let's just say the people that are doing nothing, they're a part of the problem, right? Are they not a part of the problem? Because they're not a part of the solution. They're doing nothing.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So if that's so, then people that are out there supporting efforts that are not going to solve the problem, whether they're just, you know, supporting, you know, vax, you know, mandates, stopping vax mandates, stopping education, whatever. They're not demanding full compliance of the Constitution, holding public servants accountable to their oath, and so forth. Are they, I mean, they're patriots. They feel like they're doing good things. Is it right for me to be able to point my finger of judgment and say, you're a part of the problem?
I think if they're going by the letter of the contract, the Constitution, I wouldn't say they're part of the problem. But they're trying to manipulate some... like the ones who want to take everybody to court to sue them because they're violating their constitution. That's not how it's supposed to be done. So what you're doing is you're watering down the contract. And well, then if you could do that, then we can do this.
Okay.
You know, and like you said, it's part of the problem because now you're fracturing and breaking down something that's simple into something that's, you know, convoluted.
Okay.
And so, then that gives the people in power the ability to say, oh, well, you agree with that, so we can do this. Now, I don't think that people who are like right to life, I don't see how saving lives is part of the problem. But like you were talking about 10th Amendment Center, the Second Amendment, I'm sure they have good intentions, but at the same time, it comes back to the basic thing of you can't fix the problems in isolation. You have to fix the fact that they're breaking the contract.
Right. So, to me,
you can say whatever you want, GR.
Right. I understand that.
So, but yes, they're part of the problem.
Yeah. Okay. So, the accountability. Let me. So, because we talk about, you know, how people are very good at creating the gray area. The gray area is where the bacteria lives. It's the petri dish of chaos. And so, as we look at, because I had this conversation before a long time ago in different venues and what have you, but it's all about accountability. I mean, at the beginning of most of the shows, I talk about this. You know, the nature of a person who has been in office, who has actually, they know that as we spell out these things that are violations, they know that they've probably violated the Constitution. Do you think they want to be held accountable? I mean, basically, it's grounds for termination. And as a matter of fact, you might have heard me say this, Sean, that, you know, moving forward, we have to have this level of rationale where we, you know, instead of using a plunger to every seat, we have this level of, I'll call it, very short period of compassion. That, okay, you and many of you have made the mistake of violating the Constitution. This is your first and final warning. You do it again, you're gone. Now, these people over here that have been leading the charge in violating the Constitution, they're gone. So some people are going to be held accountable because they're the leaders of the insurrection. But everybody else has been held accountable by being given a first and final warning. And if you're going to get a couple of these, they're, you know, these are the little, you know, the Eddie Haskells. Did I go over everybody's head on this? Who Eddie Haskell is?
No, you didn't.
Okay. No. Tammy, you know who Eddie Haskell is? Leave it to Beaver. He's Wally's friend who's always, you know, trying to find that gray area, you know, and some way of being able to get around what the parents said. And so there's always these Eddie Haskells that you're going to go, oh, well, you know, show me how I violated, you know, how any way I violated my oath. Well, okay, so did you vote for this? Did you vote for this? Did you vote for receiving this money, unconstitutional money? I mean, there's so many ways to do it. All of a sudden, they're going to be overwhelmed, and they'll realize, oh, okay, got me. I mean, Eddie Haskells are their own worst enemies because as they try to play this game of defending themselves, they end up really exposing themselves to just how bad they really are. But nevertheless, you're going to have these folks in government that as we move and we say, this is ending. You now need, and we actually are giving you the law you need to invoke that, you know, will immediately remove somebody. And this law is going to be very much like, folks, this sexual harassment type of law. Well, what do I mean by that? Sean, are you aware of, and Tammy, are you aware of the standard laws that have been placed into states that when a person's been sexually, racially, or harassed in any way, that they feel that they're in a hostile work environment, that the employer is now been by this employee, the clock starts that when an employee reports to HR, you know, that they've done something, that this person's done something, something's happened, the company now has to basically take that person that's been named as the hostile, you know, the person creating hostility and setting them aside. In other words, they're removed from work and they're set on, you know, administrative leave. Whether they get paid or not is another story. 9 times out of 10, most companies pay. But bottom line, you're removed. And they have to do the due diligence to determine whether they have actually crossed the line or not. Now, when it comes to the Constitution, I don't trust the HRs, but I do trust these Constitution committees as we start, because by the point in time we get to this law being presented at the state level, there will be a Constitutional Compliance Committee. And therefore, the Constitutional Compliance Committee will be able to come very quickly and say, oh, yeah, you sure did, without any reservations. And as a matter of fact, the county Constitutional Compliance Committees can hold that state Constitutional Compliance Committee accountable if they feel like, oh, you just soft-pedaled that guy. Clearly, that was a violation, and you basically, you know, looked the other way. In other words, creating a system that is just impossible by creating these checks and balances. Because if we've learned anything from the Constitution, the checks and balances is what keeps people honest. Holding people accountable is what keeps people honest. Given any species enough rope, enough latitude, they will eventually hang themselves. And so we want to create a system that doesn't allow them to run off with the rope. Not for their benefit, but for ours. Because the damage that they will do, the cost that it brings to us. So anyway, I believe that, you know, this is a black and white realm. I know that there are shades of gray, you know, that do exist. But to me, it's black and white of supporting the Constitution, being a part of the solution, these types of things. And, you know, one could say, well, you're not doing anything that's not supporting, you're not doing anything that's a part of the problem. But are you doing enough to supporting the solution? That becomes the next question. But let's finally get more and more people into supporting or being a part of the solution, so that down the road we can actually say, are you doing enough? Right?
Yeah.
Because I'm just trying to look at what does it take to get to this level, to get across this barrier that we have. And so in so doing, I think that if we're capable of having these types of conversations, you know, in a civil manner, then I think we're well on the way of being able to have even the more difficult conversations, like how do we solve this problem that the federal government's created by doing this or by doing this or by doing this. And in many cases, I think that the answer will stupefy people how simple the real answers or the real solutions are, if that makes sense. So anyway, any other parting shot?
Because, I would say that the idea and the principles that you teach and talk about in Why Counties Matter Most, is going to be the solution. Because, and even here, everybody gets sucked into it because it's been crammed down our throats. I know since I was born that the federal government is this entity that, you know, you have no control over. It has your best interests at heart, and, you know, you can't fight the government. And now I've come to understand that that is nothing more than propaganda. And I understand the reasoning behind it, because we actually do have the power. If we have committees in our counties that can hold our local representatives accountable,
right,
and force them to hold the states and so on,
right,
that's how we can attack the problem in a way that everybody can have, you know, a place and a part in it.
Right, and the more we collectively work together, the more efficacious we get in attacking the problem. So, you know, it's once the movement gets started, you know, once it's kind of like the avalanche, right? Once the energy is released at the top of that hill, you know, it's just a matter of time for that to actually start picking up. The question is, has the energy been released from the top of the hill yet? Of what we've been doing, has it been released? Because there's, you know, it's still just these little teeny snowballs that are kind of moving that haven't unleashed the rest of that energy sitting on the side of that mountain. Does that make sense?
There's a saying I like, be the second person to get up and dance. the first person, everybody can just point and say, oh, look, they're kind of loony or whatever. But once the second person gets up and starts dancing, then everybody else decides that it's okay.
Right. That is the second man theory I've heard about that, where if you have somebody validate, you know, an effort, if you have somebody validate something, it really changes the game. So you're absolutely right. So with that, anything else? All right.
Nope.
So at this point, folks, we got about 12 and a half minutes left. Let's dive into what we call the actual Funding Act of 1790, where Hamilton got Congress to basically create the Assumption Act. Now, let me see here. This is, okay, so interestingly enough, when you look at the annals, the Congressional Globe, and or the Congressional Record, there's different names for the Congressional Record at different years or spans of time because they called it differently. The very first year of the Congressional Record, at the end of the year, they created a compendious summation of all of the acts passed by Congress. So they do that at the end of every year. So the document that we're looking at is actually that product of the Congressional Record that basically includes the language of each of these acts. Does that make sense? So what we're looking at in statute number 2, because this is the very first, this is the very beginning, because you're actually looking at page 138, right, on this document. So folks, if you download the document that we're talking about, the Funding Act of 1790, it's a PDF file, it's 7 pages, and it starts off at page 138. I'm just trying to explain to everybody, you know, what you're looking at. You're looking at kind of the middle of a big book or big record that identifies all of the acts that were passed in the second session of Congress that year. And so the sale of lands by Indians, in what cases valid and so forth. So these are acts that they created. And so we're looking at Statute 2 that was passed August 4th, 1790, which is actually at the very bottom of page 1. And it's called, well, they break it down as Chapter 34, an act making provisions for the, and then in brackets, payment of the, then debt of the United States, and the A being of America. Okay, so this is where they actually create the act of assuming the debts. So what we want to do, we kind of want to cover a little bit of this to set the stage so that, you know, everybody kind of understands what they're trying to do, and then we'll jump down a little bit further just to kind of cover how they're going to kind of do this. When they actually create the Bank Act, that's when they get into, I believe, the details of how much and where it goes and you know, so forth and so on. But for the sake of argument or the sake of getting this kicked off, let's start off with the very beginning, because they do identify what, why, and, you know, kind of not the how, but some of the details of why this act is being passed. So, Tammy, do you want to start off with the whereas?
Whereas justice and the support of public credit require that provision should be made for fulfilling the engagements of the United States in respect to their foreign debt and for funding their domestic debt upon equitable and satisfactory terms.
Okay, so at that point, go ahead and pick that up, Sean, with Section 1. And then, let me see, how far does Section 1 go? Okay, so, yeah, and then, Tammy, why don't you go ahead and read Section 2. And at that point, I think, and once you get Section 2 done, we'll jump down to probably Section 8. Go ahead, Sean.
Section 1, being enacted by the State and House of Representatives the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that reserving out of the monies which have arisen since the last day of December last past, and which shall hereafter arise from the duties on goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, and on the tonnage of ships or vessels, the yearly sum of $600,000, or so much thereof as may be appropriated from time to time towards the separate support of the government of the United States and their common defense. The residue of said monies, or so much thereof as may be necessary as the same shall be received in each year, next after the sum reserved as aforesaid shall be, and is hereby appropriated to the payment of the interest, which shall from time to time become due on the loans heretofore made by the United States in foreign countries, and also to the payment of the interest on such further loans as may be obtained for discharging the arrears of interest thereupon, and the whole or any part of the principal thereof, to continue so appropriated until the said loans, as well as those already made, as those which may be made in virtue of this act, shall be fully satisfied pursuant to the contracts relating to the same, any law to the contrary notwithstanding, and provided that nothing herein contained shall be construed to annul or alter any appropriation by law made prior to the passing of this act.
Okay, go ahead and read that last paragraph, and then Tammy will pick up with section two. Thanks.
And as new loans are and will be necessary for the payment of the aforesaid arrears of interest and the installments of the principal of the said foreign debt due and growing due, and may also be found expedient for effecting an entire alteration in the state of the same.
Okay, be it further enacted that the President of the United States be, and he is hereby authorized to cause to be borrowed on behalf of the United States a sum or sums not exceeding in the whole $12 million, and that so much of this sum as may be necessary to the discharge of the said arrears and installments, and if it can be effected upon terms advantageous to the United States, to the paying of the whole of the said foreign debt, be appropriated solely to those purposes. And the President is moreover further authorized to cause to be made such other contracts respecting the said debt as shall be found for the interests of the said states, provided nevertheless that no engagement nor contract shall be entered into which shall preclude the United States from reimbursing any sum or sums borrowed within 15 years after the same shall have been lent or advanced. And whereas it is desirable to adapt the nature of the provision to be made for the domestic debt to the present circumstances of the United States, as far as it shall be found practicable, consistently with good faith and the rights of the creditors, which can only be done by voluntary loan on their part.
Okay, so obviously they're creating both a mechanism of carrying foreign debt and creating revenue and paying foreign debt. So this kind of falls under the Treasury or the auspices of the authority of the Treasury. So let's jump down to, because I'm looking at three, talking about certificates and so forth. You know what? Sean, go ahead and read section three, because I think this kind of lays out what they're, you know, how this is laying the stage for a bank. Go ahead.
Can I ask a question
first? Sure, absolutely.
What was the $12 million for? I mean, I'm having a hard time. I understand they have debts and they have loans that they want to pay, but they're talking about making new loans. What exactly were they using that money for?
So that money was to be spread around going back to the states that paid their debt. In other words, they're going to create new debt with those states. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah. Okay. That's why I was confused, because you had talked about how the states, some states had paid their debts and mm-hmm. others had more. So what they're doing is they're trying to find a way to balance all of that and give money back to the people who put their money out,
right,
while still paying the debts of the other states.
This is a very elaborate deal that Hamilton is making.
Right.
It is so elaborate that it, I think it even pales, you know, in comparison to even today, most banking thinkers. In other words, I don't think Hamilton, being a lawyer, I don't think Hamilton understood finance to this detail. I believe he was given all of this help from Britain,
right,
to basically create a situation that would create a higher volatility in the union as long as the federal government kept on its merry way of, just help me out here, basically spending money and taking on debt. In other words, what would have happened had the John Adams administration, had Thomas Jefferson and Madison not been able to correct the nation by basically committing their coup, getting away with it, and reeling the bank in and basically getting rid of that charter, closing out the charter and finishing the bank and its deals by moving forward with no charter until Madison had to do that. I think it all set the stage to, you know, lay out that we were heading down a path that Hamilton was putting us on that would have actually destroyed this experiment that we put us on.
I think if he would have been successful, mm-hmm, that we would have been back under the British monarchy.
Before
long.
The success actually came, but it came under the wrong watch. What do I mean by that? When did the first charter fail? If you look it up, you'll find it happened on Thomas Jefferson's watch. And so the president that was in office when everything basically went belly up, because this first bank, the charter, actually went bankrupt. And what they ended up doing and creating, Jefferson just started paying it down. Not creating a bank, not doing anything other than, we're just, now that we've got the revenue and we've got everything kind of in motion, we're not taking on more debt. We're going to live with the debt we have and we're going to pay that down. It wasn't until Madison came along where he had to create more debt. Anyway, so go ahead, Tammy, let's go with three. Thank you.
Oh, I was going to read three.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Doesn't matter, but I mean,
oh, hold on here. Stop the presses. It's time to actually wrap things up. So I apologize that I wasn't watching that. We'll pick up three. Sean, you and I will pick up three in our next episode. And with that, folks, I'm hoping what we're doing is helping. I hope that you become a part of the solution, a full part of the solution. And that you can actually, you know, your reward will be waiting for you in heaven, kind of thing. It's one of those righteous things that we all need to be doing. With that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.